know, I can eat a peach for hours.
Do you want lunch?
You're A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
I can't talk too long. I gotta poo.
Oh, no, no, not the peach! Not the peach! Ah!
It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of Effin' Birds Presents Travolta Cage, a podcast about the two greatest actors in cinema history. I'm Clint Worthington. I'm the editor-in-chief of The Spool and a senior writer for Consequence of Sound.
My name is Nathan Rabin. I want to shake you naked and eat you alive. My name is I read for the Nathan Rabin's Happy Place, and I'm the co-host of the podcast that you are listening to now.
And this week we're joined by a wonderful returning guest. You know him, you love him, Alonzo Duraldi. Alonzo, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks?
Glad we brought you back for this this most illustrious entry in Walter Cage's filmography. Why don't you tell the people what you do?
Well, I co-host a ridiculous amount of podcasts, notably...
You just added another podcast, and I felt so worried for you when I saw that announcement.
I don't know where they go. Most notably, Linoleum Knife, which I've been co-hosting with my husband, Dave White, for going on, it'll be 10 years in November. But I am also the co-host of the Breakfast All Day, Who Shot Ya, and now a film and a movie podcasts.
Now, for those just joining us who don't know what this podcast is about somehow, not intuiting the name... we are going through the filmographies of John Travolta and Nicolas Cage in chronological order, pairing them off to see where their careers intersect, where they diverge, where these two fascinating figures sort of match on the Hollywood landscape. And we are finally, we got close last week, but I think finally this week, Alonzo and I were just talking before recording, their timelines have merged. We have caught up. They are both movies from roughly the same time period. And so we're going to be talking about two movies that you've definitely heard of, Sandali and Chains of Gold.
Well, they battled for Best Picture at the Academy Awards in 1991, yeah. And they actually tied, which is remarkable since one of them debuted on Showtime, and the other went direct to video. But we will all remember them as these twin titans of cinema that absolutely dominated their era, and for a very good reason, they're stone cold masterpieces.
If you want to support us talking about this stuff, you should please pledge to our Patreon, patreon.com/TravoltaCage. Anything you can do to keep the lights on. Obviously, times are hard right now, and everyone's donating money to much more worthy causes, so give them to that first. But if you have any scratch left over, please send it to our humble selves. And with that out of the way, let's get started with our first film, Sandali.
She was young, beautiful, and married, but she was not desired.
I want you like we used to want.
She had everything, but she was not fulfilled.
God, it has nothing to do with you.
Until a stranger entered her life.
I know what you really are.
I make no excuses for what I do.
And swept her into a world of insatiable passion.
I want you to move in with me.
No. It'd kill him.
You have a mistress, don't you?
Just go to him. He's your husband. Talk to him.
I can't be what you want me to be.
Yes, you can.
It's over.
You don't love him.
Nicolas Cage.
I can't get you out of me.
You don't know anything about love.
Judge Reinhold and sensational film newcomer Erica Anderson.
Keep your cap of what you want. You might just get it.
Joe!
Sandali.
So yeah, let's talk generally about where we're at in the 90s with Travolta and Cage. I feel like at this point, they are maybe roughly the same cachet in terms of star power at this point. They're both relatively like obscure / vacillating between like some strange hits. I mean, we had Look Who's Talking last time, but like...
Well, that's the incredibly perverse thing about Nicolas Cage's career is that he's doing this dodgy, pathetic, dreary... garbage fire of a motion picture like Sandali, and he's doing Wild at Heart at the same time, like the same year. So that's fascinating to me, is that he kind of oscillates between these amazing, important cult films that we all love and revere and that are the cornerstone of his legend, and movies like this where it's like, did you make this movie on a dare? And do you owe somebody money? Like, for the love of God, why would you, this brilliant, brilliant, charismatic, compelling, like, contemporary Marlon Brando, why would you make this terrible, terrible movie? But there are so many great people in this. Like, I was looking at the opening credits and thinking, like, this movie can't possibly be as bad as I remember it.
Steve Buscemi and Marissa Tomei share a title card.
They do. And I love Steve Buscemi.
Did this movie look better on paper, or were people just that desperate for a trip to New Orleans?
It's staggering
who they got for this.
It felt like there was a screenplay that they got everybody with, and then they didn't use that one. They threw that one out and got something like from Red Shoe Diaries. That was like the longest Red Shoe Diaries episode ever.
Yeah, this movie is the platonic ideal of a Cinemax film of that period. Like, it has enough of a plot, but it's really just about the humping, and it's got, you know, names you know, and in this case, like, many names you know, and like, better names you know. So down to the character actors, like Vivica Lindfors is great. And even in one scene, there's a guy who... I believe Newell Alexander is his name, who's in like a lot of Del Shore's films. Like, he's this respected sort of, you know, Dallas-based actor, and even he's too good for this. Like, I felt bad for everybody involved, including the city of New Orleans, and later I'll feel bad for the city of Miami. So, you know,
wait, this was filmed in New Orleans?
I know. How could you tell?
I gotta tell you guys something. Y'all might not be Southerners like I'm Southerners, but New Orleans, it's a very special place. They march to the beat of their own drum down in New Orleans.
Yeah, do you guarantee?
This movie was written by that character that Heidi Gardner does on SNL. Who goes to New Orleans once and comes back talking about New Orleans.
And I have this vague memory of reading about this in Premiere. Before it came out, I don't think anticipated that it would go direct to video. And I remember Erica Andrews, and again, this might be like a weird false Kazam type memory, describing it as a total fucking art film. Which I think was true, and that it's like, it's a film with artistic pretensions that has a lot of fucking in it.
Right.
Other than that, I don't know whether it technically qualifies as a total fucking art film.
Right. Well, let's talk about Erica Anderson, the figure at the center of Sandalay, which is the first movie we're going to be talking about.
The most important actor or actress in this motion picture.
Yes. The main character. And fun fact, she has showed up in Red Shoe Diaries, apparently. But she was in Twin Peaks and The Nightmare on Elm Street 5, The Dream Child. But otherwise, wasn't she like a radio personality?
I believe so. I think that this was going to be her star-making turn. You know, this was going to be her Bo Derek in 10. This was going to be Kim Basinger in 9.5 weeks. But it didn't quite work out that way.
No. You have to feel for her, though, because I'm sure, like, she was just coming off of Twin Peaks. You know, I'm the title character in this movie with Nicolas Cage and Judge Reinhold.
They're fighting over me.
It must have seemed like, yeah, this was going to be her entree to bigger and better things. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned 9.5 weeks, because I think that movie should be blamed for this whole sort of wave of softcore. I mean, 9.5 weeks and the AIDS virus, basically. I think that is the reason why we got all of these heavy breathing, dry humpy, you know, ass shot movies of the late 80s and early 90s that are so sweaty but so not sexy.
Yes. Like, we should talk about that too, because, I mean, going back to the broader discussion of Travolta and Cage, one thing I find interesting about this, Cage is definitely like playing this Brando-esque sex god in all these. He's in that mode in his career, and Travolta is increasingly going towards like a family man, sort of like fighting for values or whatever. Like, he's sort of like, there's still a little roguishness to him, but he's definitely like going sort of straight edge, for lack of a better term.
Well, the thing that's fascinating to me about this is we have chronicled in depth, very, very extensively, like in his first decade of his career, one of Nicolas Cage's calling cards is that he was a sexy motherfucker. He was really, really, really hot, like very, very gorgeous, very attractive, an element of danger to it. You know, he had these beautiful eyes, and he had this incredibly cut, fit body, you know, and these teeth and this hair and this charisma. And like,
put a pin in the hair. We'll get back to it.
His hair needs a lot of pins, let's say.
It's staggering how sexy and how appealing and how charming. I mean, like Valley Girl. Like, I have a huge fucking man crush on him in Valley Girl because he was such a dynamic and lovable and sweet and sexy character. And then here, where he makes the big leap into making a fuck film, into doing like his version of, you know, Last Tango in Paris, and he could not be less sexy. He could not be more physically repulsive. It's almost as if he sat down in costume and makeup every day and said, make me look like garbage. Make me look as terrible as possible. And they're like, you fucking got it, man. There's another thing binges on you being the sexiest person in the world. Right. And we're going to make you look like a flaming garbage fire of a human being.
Well, and also not just the hair, the facial hair, too. It's like this half-baked attempt at a goatee.
He looks like he's wearing a Guy Fawkes mask. He looks like he's trying to...
It's more like a Guy Fieri mask.
Yeah. But the soul patch, the mustache. I was watching
Flavor Town was New Orleans all along.
I was watching this, and I felt like Tommy Wiseau must have seen this and vaguely remembered it and then like set out to make a Tennessee Williams movie.
He confused
movie.
It with Streetcar.
Oh. Well, and then accidentally remade this movie because Nicolas Cage is Johnny.
Every
and
time someone
Mark
says Johnny, all I could
person.
Think of was Tommy Wiseau.
He's got Tommy Wiseau hair in this. It's dyed jet black for absolutely no reason. It looks like total garbage. It has like this weird mullety quality to it.
And sometimes a ponytail, sometimes not.
He'll be fucking, and I'll just like I'll just be obsessed with his ponytail, with his jet black ponytail. It seems like he took a Sharpie and just colored it all over his hair. It's astonishing how ugly he is in this. It also feels like he lost all his muscle definition. Like he used to have a really nice body and then he let it all go for the movie where he spends a third of
it fucking.
The only
time he looks
fucking.
Ripped is when he covers himself in black paint and then you start seeing some bulges.
Including his face. We get to see Nicolas Cage paint black face all over his, oh my God.
And
he's not the one who is spiritually a paraplegic. In this motion picture, is he not? Oh, so let's start at the beginning. Clint, can tell me about the magic and the wonder and the voyage of sexual self-discovery that is Zandali.
I will do my damnedest. So, as you can intuit, perhaps, Zandali is set in New Orleans, or as we should say, Nolens, and follows the titular Zandali, who works at a clothing store with a cross-dressing Joe Pantoliano. Yes,
another character actor way too good for this thing.
Right. In a dissatisfied, loveless marriage with Judge Reinhold's Terry Martin, who is just, he used to be this passionate love affair and this beautiful marriage, but he started getting into his, his career. He took this dead end job for security, his dad's communication business.
He didn't just have a fiery, fiery, passionate life. He used to be a poet.
That's a poet.
And we get to hear a whole lot of his poetry via all of his dialogue.
Oh my God. It is written like a dime store Kindle erotica ebook. I gotta say. And so he starts to withdraw from her. Zandali is real hard up for some D and finds
also,
it.
Also he can't get it up. It's very important to put out that he is impotent.
He's physically and spiritually impotent.
It's almost as if there's some relationship between him selling out, him being unable to perform sexually or creatively.
See, that's how capitalism kills.
He's trapped in the shadow of his father.
Oh, I see. Well, meanwhile, Cuck Reinhold crosses paths with Nicolas Cage. Who I think is an old friend,
childhood friend,
of Terry. And of course, he wants to paint a portrait of them, I believe. That's sort of where Zandali and Johnny enter this torrid love affair because, of course, he's so rugged and passionate, and can get it up and fucks her in a confessional booth. Like, it's so fucking, it's so goddamn poetic about how sex is church and, all this stupid dime store pulp novel bullshit. And so that's sort of where it ends up sort of going. The relationship deteriorates, everything gets more passionate, and Terry starts to get wise as to their affair, but like kind of way too late, way later than he should have, let's be honest. But that's sort of the general thing. It's your dime store sort of like you said, amped up Skinamax movie.
But I think it's important to point out that the dialogue for this is insane. And this is, I think, one of the first sort of instances of Nicolas Cage making a movie that people remember for the wrong reasons. And the people quote for the wrong reasons for movies that become a cult movie of the, can you believe how fucking terrible that movie is and how insane Nicolas Cage is in it? As opposed to, that movie is great and I love it. My God, he's such a ridiculous caricature of like a tortured artist. This is actual dialogue from the motion picture. I don't care who you are, Donald Trump, who the hell. Without creativity, without life, then you are truly unable to go straight up the devil's ass, look him right in the face, smile, and survive.
I'm still trying to figure out how you could go up someone's ass and then look them in the face.
And I'm just amazed at how impressed Judge Reinhold is by Nicolas Cage. He's like, oh, you say such funny things and you're so clever. Oh, God. And there's a moment where...
I just really needed their mustaches to rub together.
Yeah, he's literally licking whipped cream off a stripper's breasts within 37 seconds of the movie. He's like, he has a sort of body language that he's going to start playing saxophone in a perfume commercial. It is absolutely ridiculous how they took, again, the most charismatic, appealing, charming, sexy figure in the world and turned him into somebody who you want to walk away from, in part because he looks like he's never bathed.
Oh, yeah, no, he comes off as a total creeper. And then there's also one of those movies, and Hallmark does this a lot, by the way, where you are left to wonder, are we supposed to think that he's a shitty painter because these paintings are shitty? Or does the movie not know these paintings are shitty and we're supposed to think he's a good painter?
I think we're supposed to think that Judge Reinhold is a very talented poet, yeah, and Nicolas Cage is a very talented painter. There's this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful line at the very end where I think he's getting coked up at this point, where it's explicit that he's doing a lot of coke and binge drinking all the time. And Zach Galligan is a wonderful, wonderful cameo.
Also as, too good for this movie.
Yeah, as an
somehow,
art dealer.
Gremlins 2's Zach Galligan.
Totally. And he's like, I really love these paintings, and like, that painting's really good. He's like, oh, I did it a while ago. He's like, well, it's really nice. And he gets really angry and he yells at Zach Galligan, who wants to buy his paintings. In 75 years, you're going to be fucking dead, and I'll be standing next to Picasso and Vincent. And I love that he's on a first name basis with Vincent Van Gogh.
He actually meant character actor Vincent Schiavelli. It was a very odd reference.
Picasso is very standoffish, but Van Gogh is a very calming person.
Yeah, they're besties. Yeah, and you were saying, like, Terry's poetry is awful. Like, who among us can withstand the wild pain of love's demand? Like, I think the shittiest thing about the poetry is that it rhymes. Like, I think rhyming poetry that's supposed to be genius sounds so amateur.
Well, and again, I think, like, the poetry that, well, the dialogue that Nicolas Cage says is supposed to be sort of this vulgar, pulpy poetry as well. Like, there's this line where Zandali, it's easy to remember what her name is, where she's like, oh, that must be a fine affair to have naked women coming into your studio and taking off all of their clothes. And Nicolas Cage, and this is the kind of banter that gets her to want to have sex with him constantly and betray her husband and all of her values. Yes, it is, darling, when that big red snatch is coming right up against your face like a freight train. It's pretty hard to paint, I tell you what.
And we'll fuck like animals in the altar of the primal.
Ugh. Oh, and again, as I said earlier, like, yeah, there is a line where he literally says, I want to shake you naked and eat you alive.
Yeah.
And she can't resist that line. She's like, holy shit, you can have me, you disgusting, rebellant-looking man. He also looks like he hasn't, again, this takes place in New Orleans, he looks like he hasn't seen the sun in several months. It really felt like, again, it felt like The Room, and that Johnny was a vampire. And they didn't get around to it because they're always already throwing enough shit at you. But,
she,
you know,
should have
hashtag subtext.
Said, I didn't realize you wrote such bloody awful poetry.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Like, when I go in my kitchen to make toast, I smell your skin.
Oh, God, yes.
Oh, God.
Are you having a stroke, Nicolas Cage?
Yeah. Honestly, like a lot of these sort of love triangles, I can't help but wonder if Zandali is just a conduit, like a proxy for Judge Reinhold and Nicolas Cage to actually get together. As evidenced by... Yeah, that sort of happens in the third act when everyone sort of knows what's going on.
In the third act when things go crazy.
Was that?
I said in third act when things go crazy.
Yeah, they finally go crazy there.
No, the scene where the two of them like dance together, and it's very much this sort of competition of like male primacy, and they're like, they've got locked eye contact. That's the sexiest moment in the movie.
Isn't it?
Because I at least believe it, and I see where it's coming from, and I understand the intent behind it. The rest of it is just sort of like, oh, okay, we're forgetting also when Zandali tells Nicolas Cage that Thierry used to be a poet, and he jams his finger into her vagina and says, isn't this poetry?
He literally grabs her by the pussy.
He does.
Yes.
He talks about Donald Trump earlier, and then he goes and he grabs her by the pussy. And again, it's just this thing where he just seems so vile, and it's supposed to seem sexy. It's supposed to be transgressive. They fuck in a church. And all I'm just thinking is, like, again, you're going to throw out your back fucking standing up. And again, like, what do you see in this man other than your husband can't get it up? And he's this tragic figure who. Here's a question, though. Would this be a better movie if they switched roles? Judge Reinhold and Nicolas Cage.
I don't know. It would have been more interesting. It would have been more interesting to see Cage, like, go outside of his, like, outre, you know, Brando persona and try to just, like, play a square, like, play the Patrick Wilson role for once.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why Nicolas Cage seems so weirdly unimposing and unimpressive physically here, is because Judge Reinhold is a very tall man. And the Erica Alexander is very, very tall as well. So not only does he seem way uglier than in all of his other movies, but he seems weirdly a lot shorter as well.
He also seems like he's just trying too hard, too. Like, there's such effort put into this persona. Like, the first time you see Nicolas Cage, he's silhouetted against a door. Yeah. And he's, like, hunched over and, like, whips his hair back and forth like Willow Smith and then, like, gyrates his hips. And it's just so much. I'm like, oh, no. You immediately know, you recognize that guy who's trying way, way too hard to be a bad boy.
It's like
boy.
The college freshman who buys, like, a painting easel but also a cricket bat. Like, he's still putting it together, but he just wants you to know that he's, like, something
it's
special.
Everyone who's had a leather jacket phase.
But there's nobody that he's fucking that we're supposed to understand that, oh yes, she can't control herself around him, you know. This movie, we're not supposed to think, ugh, you know, he's repellent, because if we do, then where does that leave us? Why do we care what happens to Zandali if her taste is that bad?
Let's talk about the sex scenes then, because they're so inartfully filmed. Like, I wrote in my notes that it just, the fakest fucking sex scenes, just childlike bouncing. And yeah, it's all, like, even when Judge Reinhold finally gets it up and, oh boy, see all our parts work. It's like a 14-year-old's conception of what sex is. Yeah.
Yeah. As much as, like, I remember mocking 9.5 weeks for when they're, like, having sex inside the giant clock or under the, like, you know, hepatitis water that's streaming down from a gutter somewhere. Like, by comparison, that's a work of genius next to the nonsense we get in this movie.
Right. And again, going back to all the New Orleans stuff, which convinced me that this movie takes place in the Hard Target cinematic universe. I want a Nicolas Cage JCVD crossover where Chance Devereaux meets up with Johnny.
And you've got Aaron Neville and Joel Saunier, who presumably know what New Orleans is actually like, who are just along for the ride in this crazy thing. I've never heard a bartender tell somebody to stop drinking more often than Aaron Neville does in this movie.
He's very responsible about over-serving.
He's also stuck with a lot of the exposition for the Nicolas Cage B-plot that means absolutely nothing until the last 2 minutes of the movie.
I will say, like, as someone who's only ever heard Aaron Neville's singing voice, it was very jarring to me that he does not sound like he sings.
You should stop drinking
cotton, the fabric of our lives.
I just wish he'd just said all his lines like that. It would have been great.
Well, when talking about Zandali, we can't ignore the insanity of the third act that happens after Terry sort of, you know, gets wise to Johnny and Zandali's love affair and hatches this strange suicidal plan to meet them out by the bayou. For an odd reckoning of sorts, and it's just so bizarre.
Again, you know, this is a Tennessee Williams Emile Zola tragedy sort of filtered through Red Shoe Diaries.
Filtered through Red Hot Chili Peppers.
If Zalman King were their manager,
for sure. And yeah, I probably actually thought that this was a Zalman King joint. Because it definitely has that vibe, it definitely has that feel, it definitely has that sensibility, it definitely has that aura of being pure garbage. So in the third act, Cherie, sad laugh, reaches an even more tragic end when he ends his own existence. And this makes Johnny very, very sad. And there's this wonderfully terrible moment where he, in his desolation and his desperation, and his sadness and his anger, he destroys his studio. Terrible, terrible waste there. And he dumps black paint on his face and his body. And what I can only describe as being a very poor choice for any number of reasons, both aesthetic and creative and otherwise.
My husband walked through the room during that scene and just kind of raised an eyebrow. And I said, well, it's not technically blackface. And he said, well, it's not blackface.
Right. But even like before the drowning itself happens, like something changes in Terry that that is so wild. Like that's sort of the moment when like Judge Reinhold finally gets a fire out from under him and he goes into strange histrionics. But even before that, we have this strange Zydeco dance between Nick Cage and Judge Reinhold that is sexier than any of the actual sex scenes in the film.
Yeah, no, that's the one moment where it feels like two human beings are making a connection, which we have not really had up until this point.
Well, and I also love that they really, again, Johnny has no reason to rein it in anymore, so he really lets his freak flag fly. There is this wonderful, wonderful moment where Zach Galligan and his bizarre cameo as an art dealer who's very, very supportive, but he's not supportive in the exact right way. So he tells Johnny, like, oh, I really love this painting. It's really, really good. He's like, well, I did that 3 months ago. It's like old art. It's garbage to me. And he's like, well, it's good. Maybe you can go in that direction. And he yells at him, in 75 years, you're going to be fucking dead. And I'll be up there standing next to Picasso and Vincent. And I love again the idea that this terrible, terrible, objectively terrible painter sees himself in that light, and also that he's on a first name basis with a great painter who he sees as a peer who has been dead for about a
hundred. Oh, he and Vinny go way back. Yeah.
Pablo's kind of a jerk. You don't really get that kind of access, but
he calls him P Dog. You know, P Dog and Vinny, they're going to be up there collecting their props, you know.
Well, please, Mr. Van Gogh is my father.
Leonardo da Vinci is going to be up there as well. There's going to be a whole host of, you know, the Last Supper of the great painter.
He shrieks at Zach Galligan, and then he's like, well, let's have a drink sometime. Like, like a lane.
Yeah, it's so, so wild. But yeah, even in that sort of, that excruciating, like, reckless boat adventure in which Terry drowns himself. He's full on. He's got a gun, I think, and he's shooting it off. And he's like, oh, what is it? Sometimes the backwoods, they come to you. It's just so wild line readings. And like, Alonzo, you like, what does he say when he's drowning or whatever? What does Zandali say when Terry's drowning?
Zandali gets my favorite line in the movie when he is, you know, in the water and Johnny thinks, oh, don't worry about it, he can swim. She says, he's trapped in the hyacinth.
Which again is the name of my book of poetry.
Talking about sort of favorite lines, I was mentioning this to Clint before we started recording, but one of the most iconic of the many, many iconic lines in this motion picture is when Johnny, in hardcore seducer mode, tells Zandali, we're inevitable. I want to shake you naked and eat you alive, Zandali. And I couldn't help but think about the Avengers Endgame and how much more interesting of a motion picture it would have been if Zanos had said, I'm inevitable. And instead of saying, and I'm Iron Man, Iron Man had responded, I want to shake you naked and eat you alive, Thanos. Again, would have automatically taken it to, you know, the Triple X parody. But I think that would have been a weird. I would like to have seen how Thanos would have responded to that.
I have as much trouble figuring out shake you naked as I do going up to the ass and looking him in the face. Like, it's the physics poetry of these comments make no sense to me at all.
It's poetry. Like fondling genitalia. It's poetry. Everything about this movie is poetry.
Yes. I was trying to figure out how you would shake one naked, like what the logistics of that. Is that more of a centrifuge scenario, or is it like just extreme vibration that the clothes just come off?
Well, they have a lot of weird physics questions on this. I mean, there was that line about, you know, going up the devil's ass and into his mouth. Which again, I think we all want to see like a computer model of to what exactly that would look like. Because it's very, I mean, it's supposed to sound cool, supposed to sound badass. It's just very confusing.
I guess if you're looking at the devil's face from the inside of his face, maybe?
Maybe. I think that's something else we should also have put in Avengers Endgame with Ant-Man. You know, that classic question, could Ant-Man just kill Thanos by shrinking, going up into his butthole and enlarging?
He could have gone up the devil's ass, looked at him, smiled, and survived.
Presumably,
again, that was in, I think, one of the treatments for Avengers Endgame.
I think that was
we're going to describe how he won.
That was one of the million scenarios that Doctor Strange worked out.
the one time it was going to work.
Well, I mean, also, such the incredibly random ass tragedy of the incredibly stupid ass, why on earth would anybody care, tragedy of how this ends. Which is Johnny being a degenerate and a creep and the worst person in the history of the world, also the least attractive person in the history of the world. EO is some money to some very, very bad characters. Did they establish whether it's for gambling or was it cocaine or like...
Oh, all those Aaron Neville scenes, I think it's all about drugs and not being paid for them or something.
No,
right.
It's so nothing until it's everything.
And it's weird too that he's obviously out of his mind on cocaine this entire movie, but it seems like they introduce that in the last 15 minutes.
Yeah. And then we finally get the payoff to that, to the subplot that we all forgot about if we ever paid attention to it in the first place, that leads to the oh-so-tragic death of Vandali, who leaps in front of that bullet like she wanted to in the first place.
Oh, and I said in my review of this piece, it goes up on Monday on my website, like, there are so many better men to take a bullet for. Like, on the list of men worth taking a bullet for, he's, like, below Kevin Federline. He's below
John Gosselin.
This is a terrible, terrible... Doug Hutchinson. I mean, again, he's a really scuzzy human being. It's a real waste. I mean, you were no treat either, sadly. Like, you were kind of a flaming garbage monster of a human being. But even you... could have gone out in a more honorable way.
I think taking that bullet has Judge Reinhold is dead all over it. Well, far more than I must save Nicolas Cage.
Right. It's just such a writerly way to end that movie too.
Well, it's such a writerly motion picture, you know, and there's just this sense of just these hard, hard lines, and they just think so highly of it. Poetry, and there's, I would say there's nothing there, but there's, at one time there's nothing there. And there is way, way, way too much there.
You know, it's worth mentioning. I know we touched on, you know, Tommy Wiseau and all this, but when in the original advertising for The Room, before he decided to go with the whole, oh no, it was a comedy all along, they dropped the name Tennessee Williams constantly. Like, you know, a drama in the mold of Tennessee Williams. And clearly this movie thinks, well, we're set in New Orleans. So we're already halfway there.
Right, come on.
This is totally making me think about Nicolas Cage in the lead role in The Disaster Artist. I think he's way too fucking old for it, but if he can do Tiger King, he could, you know, with some CGI antics there, he could totally nail that role. He could capture the essence of Tommy Wiseau as Tommy Wiseau captured the essence of Johnny in Zandali.
Well, and Alonzo, you were asking how old Tommy Wiseau is. I think we don't know. I think maybe he's in his mid-60s. That's what Wikipedia says. But like so much of him, like his nationality and everything, so much of him is a tight
shrouded in mystery.
Right. So, you know, so there's that. So here we have Zandali, a movie that is sort of the reverse Room. It's like, I was thinking about this. We keep making the Room comparisons, but it's like the Room if Johnny were Judge Reinhold, because he's the one that's being cucked.
Right.
And by the virile Mark, who's the best friend. And so it's such a strange confluence of influences. Like it's very interesting. It's like we said, it's an amped up Skinemax picture.
And it also feels too like sort of the Room technically takes place in San Francisco. Spiritually, it takes place in Nolens. And again, that's not New Orleans, the city. It's Nolens, the idea, the hokey. Theme park idea that this movie exploits.
Nobody can be impotent in the Room because that would deprive us of a nude scene.
Right. Got to see those butts.
I did like the Zydeco score, and then we got to hear the very sexiest of all instruments, the accordion.
Yeah, the score was by a group called Pray for Rain, which I think just does like stocks. Yeah, they just do like stock movie soundtracks. Like, I even think, I feel like it's kind of one of those things where you get like a company that does nothing but trailer music to do the actual music for your movie.
Yeah, they did the score for Sid and Nancy, but I mean, who remembers the score for Sid and Nancy? You remember the Sid Vicious songs, you know?
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, I mean, yeah, probably the most egregious bit of New Orleans Color, other than Aaron Neville as the bartender for some reason, was Steve Buscemi, a very young sort of just pre-stardom Steve Buscemi, who very early in the film cackles to Zandali, "Remember, nothing's as good as they say it is. Nothing, not even me, and I do something awful pretty good."
Again, how do you do, fellow Cajuns? Like,
oh, 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 I'm so big. Don't both do.
Oh, yeah, it's always fun to hear Steve Buscemi do accents.
It is, and I just love that phrase, "something awful pretty good." And I feel like that sort of captures something about this movie, because it is absolutely awful, and yet there is something about it. There's like this quality, there's a stickiness to it. There's something that kind of makes it...
Well, that's mostly really the humidity. That's the New Orleans humidity that makes it so sticky.
Yeah, it's the Nicolas Cage factor. I feel like if somebody else plays Johnny, somebody who doesn't have personality, somebody who doesn't have life, somebody who doesn't turn this into like this crazy carnival of a character, like this is just a deadly, pretentious, lame, unsexy fuck film. I feel like, yeah, there's that kind of that X factor that Nicolas Cage brings to movies that kind of makes a transcendent piece of garbage. As opposed to just being
right.
If they did a new kind of Cheetos with an artificial cayenne pepper flavor, and then they made Chester Cheetah speak with a Cajun accent, that would be this movie.
Yes. Oh God, some Bourbon Street Crunch. All right. Well, let's move on to a movie that is a little less like romantically lurid, but just as sort of Reagan-esque in its conception of moral urban decay. Chains of Gold.
You got only one thing to live for. That is the program. You break the rules.
Please.
You hurt everybody.
Burn him! Burn him! Burn him! Burn him!
Listen, Barnes, you've been bucking the system since you got here.
I don't have time for the people I've got. Now you've just doubled our caseload.
If you were doing something like you were in a club or something, and you wanted to quit, but you were afraid to.
If anyone hurts you, you let me know and I'll take care of it. You understand me?
Tommy hasn't been home for the past couple of nights, and I'm getting worried.
Go home. Stay home where it's safe. Do some social work.
He's quit. Do some.
If they've got him, there's no way you're going to get him out.
That's gold. And them are diamonds.
When you work hard, you could be like me.
What is a beautiful woman like you doing all alone in a bar like this?
I'm not alone. I'm with you.
There must be some way you can get me in there.
I'm their lawyer. I'm not their business partner.
All right, everybody, wake up!
They'll meet with you. You're on your own.
Let me set you straight. The name of the game is Youth Incentive Program.
This is your basic hookup job.
I gotta get out of here, man.
No, don't do that, Tommy. It's a bad idea.
I warned you.
If I don't find him soon, I'm going to find him dead.
Keep an eye on him day and night. If he's not fooling, you kill them both.
Bad news, bro. Scott's dirty.
Jackie! Jackie!
Come on. Carlos wants you nice and healthy.
Both you and I know that if he's caught, he's a dead man.
Welcome to the Gator Bowl, baby. It's almost time for kickoff.
If you think one man can't make a difference, think again. Travolta. Chains of Gold. Only from Academy Entertainment.
Nathan, tell us about Chains of Gold.
Oh, sure. Well, I'd say the word lurid is the perfect word to describe this abomination. This is the only motion picture, and I'm saying that very generously, to have a screenwriting credit by John Travolta. He's one of four scribes who took, you know, pen to paper to tell this important story about two generations of white sitcom hunks fixing Miami's inner city crack problem. We have here John Travolta, basically as a social worker who is a cop. And everything other than in job and profession, he 100% is a cop. And he even has the backstory of a cop once upon a time, roughly 4 years before the film started. He was an advertising executive, and he was a drunk, and he was a terrible, terrible person. And because he was a terrible person, he got into a drunk driving accident that claimed the life of his child. And because of that, he got on the wagon, and then he left the soul-sucking profession of advertising behind so that he could become a social worker, and a very passionate social worker, and a maverick social worker, and a social worker who plays by his own rules. He doesn't like spending time at the desk. He wants to get in the field. And his
if you're white.
Yes, exactly. And his most important slash only client is this 13-year-old white boy, Tommy, who's played by Joey Lawrence of Blossom. And yeah, there's a fascinating scene early on where John Travolta is talking to like one of his only other clients, and it is a black mother. And he's very sternly telling her that she better not spend this money on crack. She better spend it on her baby. She better be spending it on baby food and not that crack cocaine that she so desperately wants to smoke. And I was thinking, like, okay, is this going to be a character? Is there going to be a second scene? Are we going to, like, get to hear her story? No. You know, we don't hear anybody's story who's black or who's brown. It's only interested in this white kid. And this white savior narrative, and usually white savior implies that the white savior saves a person of color. That doesn't happen here. It's so tone deaf. It's so clumsily, half-assedly racist that it's about a white dude who enters this incredibly dangerous, lurid comic book exploitation fever dream of like a black and brown crack game. There are crack prisons, there are crack factories, which I call cracktories. Yes. There's even a crack awards show, which is kind of amazing. And yeah, the big crack killer who's played, he's Carlos. He's played
Tony Montanas.
Well, I'm sort of saying that, you know, this debuted on Showtime. So he's kind of like Tony Hannah Montana. Yeah. And he's very, very excited. You know, he's got his own crack prison, he's got his own crack factory. And then he gives us awards to whoever does the best job selling crack, gets this giant chain of gold, the titular chain of gold. So it's sort of the Crack Academy Awards, it's the golden crack rock, as it were.
The Tupperware convention where, you know, you're the regional number one vendor, you know.
Exactly.
Right.
Your crack Mary, magazine's crack salesman of the year.
Mary Kay gives you a pink Cadillac.
Exactly. So John Travolta realizes he can only do so much as the world's most devoted social worker. So he quits his job in disgust, or he's thrown off the job in disgust. They take his badge, they take his gun. So then he decides to go from being a social worker to selling crack cocaine. And Carlos, despite being presented as very, very paranoid, you know, maybe a little bit on the dust, maybe getting high on his own supply, like he doesn't trust anybody. But this social worker comes in and is like, hey, I want to get into the crack game. Will you be my boss? And he's like, of course, of course. Here, I'll have my flunky show you all of our crack secrets.
You don't seem like a narc.
Exactly. Not at all.
If he doesn't suspect you for being a cop, you'd think that he would. His first thought would be, "Oh God, not another New York Magazine reporter." Because like
hard-hitting profile,
the parole testing coverage of
crack. Barry Weiss, not you again.
That was the epidemic.
So what happens is that there is this ridiculous, ridiculous, wonderfully, wonderfully lurid climax in which Carlos realizes that John Travolta's character is a social worker, and not even a social worker, a fired social worker, an excellent worker, an unemployed social worker. And he's like, oh, I was going to, you know, do some sort of horrible thing to you because I thought you were a DA agent or you're a cop, but now that you're a social worker, I'm just going to kill you by throwing you down an elevator shaft to a pit of hungry alligators.
Yes.
I like to call them crocodiles.
That is awesome. So what happens is he's thrown down an elevator shaft to a bit of hungry crocodiles, but he escapes. He gets caught up in the wires and he suddenly develops like these Jason Bourne, James Bond reflexes. And he makes his way out back up there and he pushes Carlos into the elevator shaft and he gets eaten by his own crocodiles. And that's he hoisted on his own petard, as it were. And that's, you know, that old maxim that he who lives by throwing people down to 100 crocodiles also dies by getting thrown down to 100 crocodiles.
Poetic justice.
It works on so many different levels.
The idea with the whole youth intervention project in a movie where you have like what seems to be a legit nonprofit for children that is actually a cover for a nefarious scheme to turn children into your crack rock slaves. That's a great name, but without that, it's just kind of like, oh, that's your nefarious gang name.
It's like, what if Dare were in on it?
Exactly. Yeah. And that comes up a lot, like in Sam Fuller's The Naked Kiss, for instance. Like the guy who is seemingly the big philanthropist and like does all these children's charities is the secret pedophile, you know. So like that's a plot element that could have worked, but it's like that maybe that existed in the first draft and then Travolta took all that stuff out, but he kept the name.
yeah exactly. And that's sort of the weird thing about watching a movie that Travolta has penned, because you can sort of see the mind behind what he's doing. Like, it's, I don't know, I think he really thinks he's being creative, but like everything about it is so stock. It's like, it's just like a cop drug drama from like the pre-Broken Window era, in Miami.
I almost got the sense that this is sort of like some weird Scientology-fueled messaged movie where they're like, oh, this is why our technology totally works. If you just gave us all power, we would wipe out the problem of crack cocaine in the inner city.
Yeah. I'm surprised nobody goes to Narcanon.
We have not talked about the central role that adorable teen heartthrob Joey Lawrence plays in this, where he is the one white child, the one cherubic white child in this black and brown nightmare world of gangs and violence. And
of course, his involvement is what gets authorities to actually pay attention.
Oh, totally. And that part is realistic. So basically what happens is he's immersed into this horrible crack game, where if you do anything wrong, you get thrown into the crack prison. And then if you're really, really bad, what they do is they throw you down an elevator shaft to a group of alligator pits.
I believe they're crocodiles.
Oh, I love that. And there's this wonderful, wonderful scene where the big bad guy, who's played by Benjamin Bratt, he's Scarface, except that he's on cable. This debuted on Showtime. So in my mind, he's Tony Hannah Montana.
He's Tony Wyoming.
He totally plays us as if people are going to have like his character airbrushed onto their van. They're going to make t-shirts about this. They're going to start quoting him in rap songs. Like, he really thinks that he's Nino Brown or Al Pacino. And again, it's like Nicolas Cage in Zandali, where it's a bad performance, but it's so operatic. It's so over the top. It's so crazy that it's a lot of fun. Like, a lot of the ridiculous entertainment of this, and a lot of it's so unbelievably lurid. So what happens is Joey Lawrence ends up in the crack factory. And it gets worse than that. He ends up in the crack slavery camp, and then he ends up in the they're like POW camps where he's just in a cage waiting to be thrown to the alligators. It's like the POW camp, and that's like the war on drugs. So what happens is like John Travolta's like, oh my God, this white kid is in trouble. I need to save this white kid. Things have really gotten bad. A white person is involved. So he quits. He hate quits his job as a social worker, where they're like, ooh, you play by your own rules and are getting results and don't just sit at a desk and not care about anything. We hate you. He literally is like, I hate that you care so much and that you're so passionate about everything. So, and again, a very realistic turn of events. He's like, oh, right, I'm out of the social service agency, but I gotta go into this crack thing. I'll just tell the guy that I want to get into the crack business now. That I want to make a career shift. I used to be in advertising, then I was a social worker. Now I'm going to get kids addicted to crack. Well, I'm going to be the crack lieutenant.
He does this by sleeping with Mary Lou Henner, who is an old pal pal of his who's now the lawyer for Tony Wyoming, and like I mean it the movie tries to pretend like he's not just sleeping with her to get information, but he's just sleeping with her to get information. Yeah,
that is which again motivation. It's another cop thing. I felt like this was like the pilot for a TV show called Social Worker Cop.
Yeah,
you'll never believe what kind of cool kid, because he does every. I mean, he goes undercover like a cop does. He fucking. I gotta say, for a social worker, he handles himself with a gun. My God, it's amazing. You know, he's a total Mary Sue. Where and there's a, and again, this is one of the reasons why I didn't feel that bad about having Alonzo watch us. There is a scene where Benjamin Bratt throws John Travolta down an elevator shaft to the hungry alligators. But John Travolta, being very, very, having like, you know, being a Jedi secretly, he gets tangled up in the wires and then he gets his way out of there and then he throws Benjamin Bratt to the alligators. Oh my God. That's how this wonderful, wonderful, very subtle motion picture ends, is by them being literally thrown to the alligators, and that is no more lurid or crazy or over the top or insane. I mean, this is kind of movie too, where it begins with words, this is based on actual events.
Yeah. Which
3 minutes later, you're like, no, you're there.
Only the alligator shaft. Only the alligator shaft was real.
Like, this is true in the sense that crack cocaine exists. Other than that, we literally made every part of this ridiculous garbage movie up. Also, this you would think this would be like, oh, this is going to be like a benignly racist white savior movie where this guy, white guy comes in who, you know, is an angel and a cop and a messiah and everything, where he saves some black people. No, he doesn't care about the black people.
Oh,
the
no.
only person he cares about is the little cute white
you get
kid.
The impression that if Travolta's character could have gotten Joey Lawrence out of there, he would completely just walk away and be like, okay, fine, y'all do your crap. But leave this poor child alone. He's my surrogate son, like the son that I had, but that I killed because I used to be an alcoholic when I was in the attic.
As if that weren't like hammered home enough, there's a point midway through the movie where he's just thinking about like his ex-wife telling him like basically your son is dead because you're an alcoholic, and I was like, come on.
Well, and before I had a child, I remember thinking of like, that's so gimmicky and that's so manipulative. And you see that so often of the my drunkenness and my drug addiction led to the death of my child. And that's the most harrowing, horrible thing in the world. And of course, I would want to change 100%. And sometimes it's done really well. Like there's in Breaking Bad, Jer Burns, his character, like that was his backstory. Mm. Like that's what got him sober. But this movie, again, because it's a fucking comic book that despite its opening credits has no relationship to reality whatsoever. Also, I mean, again, talking about representation, like I didn't feel like at any point they didn't say, hey, why aren't there more black people in this movie who aren't evil, who aren't, you know, either being crack slaves or, you know, pointing a gun at Joey Lawrence or threatening Joey Lawrence.
A Rasta Man chauffeur. Let's not forget him.
Oh, dear God. I mean, it's like, why aren't black people in this story except for as bad guys and as victims? Like, and Bernie Casey is like, in this
motion
picture
as well.
Hector
Elizondo, yeah.
Well, Hector Elizondo, Casey has more dialogue than all the other black characters put together, so I guess. That's balance.
Fine.
And again, there are just these insane moments where you're, you know, kind of integrating these cop cliches, but in like a really bizarre way. Like, you know, the cops want John Travolta off the case because he's doing it better than they are. And at one point, Hector Elizondo says, "Ugh, I'm so annoyed with you. If you do this again, I'm going to arrest you for selling drugs."
It's the most and Michael like, Starn
oh,
kind of
he's like, dynamic. Oh my God, I'm not even selling any drugs. That's so unbelievable. You can't do that.
I
you're going to save all the white kids. Oh,
I kept thinking about Hardcore, where, you know, George C. Scott has to like infiltrate this world of pornography to try and rescue his daughter. And you've got Susan Hubley, who has like knows the terrain and has suffered and like helps him out. And then at the end of the movie, he rescues the daughter and just leaves Susan Hubley to her own device. Is like, well, thanks, adios. And it's kind of like, no, fuck the daughter. She's been off camera this entire movie. We don't care about her. We care about Susan Hubley. You know, and it's like, this movie is so cavalier about like all the other child slaves and all the other like suffering crack adjacent people, but it's like, nope, as long as Joey Lawrence can enter the tender embrace of John Travolta, the rest of you can all fuck off and die.
And again, it's not just that he's a white kid. He's a white kid who looks like he should be auditioning for Wonder Bread commercials. Yeah. He's a white kid whose face
aggressively
wholesome. You want to pinch his cheek. I mean, again, in a year or two, he would be a dumb sitcom hunk, just like Vinnie Barbarino.
A few years earlier, they would have gotten Ricky Schroeder.
Oh, totally. And I was thinking, like, literally, like, Macaulay Culkin would have had more grit in this role. You know, he would have brought more darkness. It would have been edgier. I mean, he was in The Good Son. Like, he would have brought so much more to this role. And you felt like, if they ever thought for even a second, why isn't this a black or brown story with black and brown lead characters, you get the sense that, oh, if we made this with John Travolta saving a black kid, nobody would want to see it, or it wouldn't get made. And they made it. It barely got made, and then it barely got seen with the cutest white kid in the world as, you know, the person that, well, John Travolta saves.
If Travolta had saved a brown or black kid, then it would absolutely be rightly accused of being a white savior movie, and yet it would still be less offensive than what.
Right. Like, make it a, I don't know, like a Denzel vehicle or something, like a mid-90s sort of Denzel action movie. Like, maybe then at least, you know, there's some sense of ownership. I don't know.
And I think part of it, too, is I feel like, you know, they kind of wanted to tell an important and socially relevant story, but through a lens of garbage and formula, and also that this is just such a ridiculous vanity project.
Yeah.
For John Travolta, I think it's kind of accepted that if somebody writes their own movie or if they direct it, then they're really going for it. And yeah, he's charismatic. He's passionate. His role doesn't make any fucking sense, and he can't sell that part, but as a silly, dumb John Travolta vehicle, I feel like, yeah, there's a certain pulpy panache to this.
I think if you grilled all the people involved, like, what is crack? Where does it come from? What does it do to people? Like, I don't know that anybody would have known. I think they're just like, they knew that crack was a thing to be upset about, and it was bad, and that's the extent of their understanding of any of this.
It's a lot of, like, urban inner city scaremongering about, like, they're going to take your kids and put them in drug prisons.
Well, there's also, again, you talk about, you know, realism, that basically after John Travolta's like, oh, I'm totally not a social worker who's the most passionate and idealistic and best social worker ever. Now I want to get kids addicted to crack. Now you just got to show me all the secrets of your crack selling factory. And he's like, oh, yeah, sure. No problem.
You don't seem like a narc.
Here's my flunky. He'll show you how everything happens. And there's a scene of, and again, in a better movie, this would actually be interesting and accurate. But instead, it's like, oh, you know, the child crack seller, he goes to the lady with the stroller, the fake pregnant woman, who then hands it off to the person with the crack. And I'm like, ugh, again, this is just like this insane right-wing racist nightmare about what the inner city is like and what it's like in Miami and what it's like, you know, in these places where these horrible black and brown people are running roughshod over the three cute white kids who happen to live in the heart of the ghetto.
Now, I don't know if you guys made this connection, but the many scenes where Travolta is driving around these seedier parts of Miami trying to find Joey Lawrence, I was immediately reminded of Lily Tomlin driving around these seedier areas of Los Angeles looking for John Travolta in Moment by Moment.
Well, that's together.
Right. Yeah. I had not thought of that before. And I guess this is kind of a bit of a dry run for the many movies in which John Travolta would play a cop. Or
like this feels like him dipping his toe in the water for, like, John Travolta action star. Like, he was a star of thrillers, like, but it's like, you know, most of it is a crime thriller, and then in the last act, suddenly you have him doing, like, Jackie Chan-esque stuff, like he's sliding down the side of a building.
Oh,
and
wow, yeah.
There's a certain level of, like, practical stunt appreciation where I'm like, okay, they really did that. This person slid down a building, or this person, like, and they treat it with, like jumping off this, like, this lifting bridge with the same gravitas as you would, like, I don't know, Captain Marvel showing up in a Marvel movie, you know, like, I don't know, there's a perverse pulp thriller part of me that appreciates that, but it also doesn't feel like the movie we've been watching for the last hour.
Oh, yeah, well, it feels like he turned into Jason Bourne.
Yeah.
To the very end there. And that in order to beat all of the crack bad guys. And then we didn't talk about this before. There's this wonderful, wonderful, terrible, terrible scene where Benjamin Bratt's trying to impress John Travolta with, like, how cool and how incredible his crack empire is. this. And he goes to a nightclub, and everybody at the nightclub is part of his big crack game.
And they're all 12.
And they're all 12 years old. They're very, very excited to be there. There are some strippers as well, you know, because you gotta get that as well. Something
Zandali also shares.
Yeah, and then he gives like necklaces. He gives like big chains to the people who sell the most crack.
It's like Chuck E. Cheese, you turn it into the
Crack Academy Awards, you know. his crack empire is so big that he can hold a Crack Academy Awards.
I love it.
And again, the Benjamin Bratt, he really, really goes for it. And I was reminded throughout this of one of the things reminded both about Benjamin Bratt, which is he was up for the lead role in Basic Instinct 2. Sharon Stone had director and actor approval, and she stated that Benjamin Bratt was not a good enough actor to have the role that David Morrissey ended up playing in Basic Instinct 2. So I always think about that. And yeah, he gives a very bad performance here, but it's a very flamboyantly bad performance. It's the kind of thing where you look it up on IMDb and people are just raving about it, like, oh, well, they remake Scarface. He should play Sosa. He is so bad and so tough and so cool.
Benjamin Bratt his due. I think he is actually a really good actor. And if you see him in like La Mission or you know, Pinheiro or something, I think he knows how to bring it. But then sometimes he gets stuck in stuff like, you know, the next best thing or Catwoman or this. And it's like, well, what are you going to do?
You can only make that level of basketball playing look realistic.
He owns the ridiculousness, you know, he owns the apparatic quality of, he's really going for it, you know. He wants us to be a villain for the ages in a movie that literally, you know, everybody forgot mere minutes after watching it.
I think when you're looking at like the montage of John Travolta's career when he drops dead or wins an honorary Academy Award or
Xenu takes him, you never know.
Exactly. Whichever comes
first. But he drops the body, as they say.
This is the movie that gets featured in the part of like, and here are the films that Pulp Fiction rescued him from.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a wild, wild ride. But it also like I found it very interesting to look at it within the lens of the time it was released. You know, this is so steeped in that sort of that war on drugs, scaremongering about, you know, like inner city youth and crack's going to take away your kids. We don't know what it is, but it seems scary and all that kind of stuff. And like the sheer organization of like, and the semi legitimization of like a crack gang that also has a child slavery ring in it just feels so ripped from like your aunt's Facebook forwards about like, don't look out if someone's coming towards you with no lights on their car, it means they're gonna kidnap you. And it's just like, it's so reactionary.
Well, and also just the idea of like this beautiful white child in this black and brown hell that must be saved by a white savior who's
like this black and brown kids
it.
Sure, they deserve to be there, but not poor Angelica.
They're presented uniformly as so monstrous, and then yes, and then the let's get the key light for Joey Lawrence, you know. I want to take a moment and park on Marilu Henner's wardrobe. There's a mention about how like because she now works for the evil drug people as their lawyer that she can afford a lot of fancy clothes. And I don't know if it's just the 1989-ness of them not aging well, or if they looked that ridiculous then, but she has like this like green spangly dress with matching pumps or these like sort of suity suit, you know, like double-breasted-y shoulder pad things going on. There's a lot of crazy going on with her wardrobe. And then we get dialogue telling us how great her wardrobe is.
And of course, she gets fridged to motivate John Travolta.
And also, especially kind of given Marilu Henner's stardom, you know, she was in Perfect with Travolta. Apparently, they dated for a little while. Something that I'm sure Marilu Henner remembers all because she has a memory where she remembers everything that happens to her. Unfortunately, she remembers appearing in this movie. And I really felt like this is not a role. This is a favor. You know, this is a nice thing that you do for your friend John Travolta, not something that gives you anything creatively to be the plot point of a lawyer who gets screwed and then gets killed.
Right.
But beforehand decides to lend their services to an evil crack game.
This smells like Burt Reynolds movies of this period. You can sense all the favors being called in.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Exactly.
And it's reminded me a little bit of like Colors, like a really terrible version of Colors of let's tell, again, this black and brown inner city story through these white characters. Because God forbid you have black characters in lead roles. A mass audience just is not going to want to see.
How can they have agency? They're all on crack.
Right. Oh man. Well, do we have any other thoughts on Chains of Gold? It's really a forgettable kind of thing.
I did, again, you know, like I said before, I felt bad for the entire city of Miami on this one, but I felt bad for Benjamin Bratt, for Conchita Farrell, even for Tammy Lauren, who like was a child star who, you know, like I don't know that she ever quite sort of found her voice as an adult or hasn't yet as an adult actress, but I just thought, oh man, y'all all just deserve better than this. And especially Conchita Farrell, because like her best roles, I think, are the ones where she's not just sort of lazily cast as like the slovenly fat lady, where she's given a personality and she's really smart and she's not taking anybody's shit. This movie, she is just there to take shit. She is there to be the fault of everything, to be the bad mom who didn't keep Joey Lawrence off the streets and who like just sits around.
Accepted his crack money.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was like, oh.
So like, I can convert this crack money into beer. It's a perfect situation here. Why are you ruining the... And there's this hilarious scene where Joey Lawrence has gone missing because he's in the crack prison. And John Travolta, as is his wont, is having dinner at their table. And she's like, you lazy sack of garbage. You don't even care about my boy. You're sitting here having dinner with us when you should be saving him with a gun and risking your life.
What are you doing?
I'm like, seriously, he's having dinner. He's the most concerned. Like,
he brought the dinner.
It's wrong that he is so incredible that he doesn't respect any kind of boundaries, but I guess it's good because, you know, he murdered all of those drug people and saved your child from a fate worse than death. But again, it's just like, as somebody who has some firsthand experience with the child care system, this set off all of my wrong.
Are you saying there was no like dedicated social worker who treated you as a surrogate child and
no
on
again
you at the
I,
expense of all of his other clients?
I had great fucking social workers that I really appreciate. They got me a scholarship for college. They didn't show up every 5 o'clock every afternoon and want to have a rap session. You know?
They didn't show up guns ablazing to the crack prison where you were in a cage.
And part of it is, you know, Joey Lawrence got like a nominated for like a Young Artist Award. He basically has one role to play in this, which is very sad that he's in a crack prison and very worried that he's in a crack prison. And at the end, very grateful that he's no longer in a crack prison.
Well, you know, Nathan, he had yet to blossom as an actor. I do appreciate like watching this movie. I was like, our Travolta voices are really Joey Lawrence voices.
Well, and I also felt like there's this weird element of, you know, passing the torch of dopey but sexy sitcom hunks. Because
they are two have to look out for their own.
Exactly, they're two of the more noted teen hunks of all time, and they're inexplicably at the core of a story that shouldn't have anything to do with white people, really.
Third act twist should have been that Travolta's character was so drunk he didn't realize that his son wasn't dead, but that they've merely taken away by the authorities, and he actually is Joey Lawrence.
Oh man, I think
that would not be any more ridiculous than what they actually put in the motion picture.
I can't decide if that would make the movie even worse or way more interesting. I would have loved it. All right, well, I think it's probably about time for us to do our cage match, where we decide somehow which of these movies is better, Zandali or Chains of Gold. Nathan, what do you think?
This is one of the hardest ones so far, because they're both such incredible garbage, but they're both kind of fun garbage. I wasn't really bored watching. I was bored watching a lot of Zandali, you know, because once they get off of the crazy stuff and once the tragedy sets in, it just gets kind of dreary. So, oh goodness, this is a real head scratcher there. Probably gonna go with Zandali though, just because it has more memorable aspects of it, and there's dialogue that I always remember from it. Whereas Chains of Gold, I will probably forget almost everything except all of the people being thrown to alligators. That part is pretty memorable.
Indeed, Alonzo, what do you think?
I mean, yeah, they're very equivalent in a lot of ways, but I think ultimately for me it boils down to a personal preference of would I rather see bad sex movie with legit actors in it or bad would-be Scarface-y, you know, primetime crime movie, and I got to go with bad sex movie, so yeah, Zandali.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go with the same thing. At least, you know, Zandali has further to fall. In terms of its ambition, because it really thinks it wants to be like an Emile Zola kind of thing. It's just real, you know, it's insane, but at least, again, there's that sort of perverse artistry to it, where at least you're getting a crazy Nick Cage performance and Judge Reinhold trying to play so hard against type and failing miserably. But yeah, like it feels more infamous, I suppose, than Chains of Gold, which feels, again, thoroughly forgettable. Like, I would believe that Chains of Gold is a made-for-TV movie before I would believe that Zandali was. Like, they both are made-for-TV quality, but, you know, I don't know. There's just a weird sense of
Zandali is so much more of a cult film such a terrible, but so bad it's good cult film, and so much kind of rooted in Nicolas Cage's craziness. Mm-hmm. Whereas, again, Chains of Gold is Travolta trying to do something, failing spectacularly in kind of a fun, weird, interesting way. Failing spectacularly.
Almost any movie with Steve Buscemi in it is better than almost any movie with Joey Lawrence in it.
Yes, that's very true.
That is true. I think Chains of Gold is a movie that deserves to be thrown to the alligators.
Indeed. So congratulations, Zandali. You survived to live and fight and fuck another day. And I think that pretty much wraps it up for this episode of Travolta Cage. Alonzo, thanks once again for coming on the show.
I would say always a pleasure, but that might be putting too fine a point on it. But.
There's an asterisk to the next to that word.
I wanted to at least not be a punishment.
It is always a pleasure to speak with the two of you, if nothing else.
No,
of course. Once again, where can people find your stuff?
If you follow me on Twitter at @aduraldi, @aduralde, I pretty much link to everything. But you can also follow the shows at @linoleumcast, @bfastallday, @whoshotyapod, and @filmandmoviepod.
You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your podcast platform may be. Wherever you do, leave us a rating and review. That also helps us out a lot. You can find me on Twitter at Clint Worthing. You can find Nathan on Twitter at Nathan Rabin. You can find our episodes at NathanRabin.com. And follow the podcast on Twitter, actually, at Travolta Cage. If you want to send us messages that we will eventually read on the air, you can email us at TravoltaCagePod@gmail.com. If you like our stuff and you want to support us, please go to patreon.com/TravoltaCage. It will mean the world to us. Thanks you so much for listening. We'll see you next time. And if you'll excuse me, I need to go poo.